massacre at Al-Shifa Hospital. Human heads eaten by crows, unidentified and decomposing body parts, and hundreds of corpses piled up and buried in mass graves are all that remained of the victims of the massacre at Al-Shifa Hospital. At least 22 patients were shot while in their hospital beds. The people who were killed, they were our fathers, brothers. They were displaced people. They were patients. They were doctors. Doctors who refused to leave their patients were executed immediately by the Israeli occupation forces. When everyone left the buildings, the army began to separate the crowds of people into groups, making each group wear differently colored plastic bracelets. The media cycle was obsessed with the targeted assassination of these aid workers when Palestinians are saying they've been doing this the entire time. They've been killing UN workers. They've been killing aid workers. They happen to be Palestinian aid workers, but nonetheless, they are aid workers and Palestinian lives are not less meaningful than the lives of foreign nationals. The massacre at Al-Shifa Hospital. And we're starting to get more and more information about exactly how the massacre went down. As we all know by now, the massacre resulted in the complete destruction of Al-Shifa Hospital and the surrounding medical complex. Every single building was destroyed by the Israeli occupation forces. The buildings were actually even torched after the Israeli occupation went in all of the buildings, carried out massacres, destroyed infrastructure from the inside. And before they left, they torched all of the buildings. And so now when you see photographs of the Al-Shifa Medical Complex, the external shell part of the buildings are black and torched. We are no longer speaking about repairs. We are speaking about the need to completely rebuild from scratch the Al-Shifa Hospital and surrounding medical complex. And unfortunately, this destruction of Al-Shifa Hospital did not get the attention that it deserved. Because if you'll remember, early on in the genocide, when the Zionists were threatening that they were going to destroy Al-Shifa Hospital, there was an immense amount of tension and pushback, even by some journalists saying, so you're going to destroy the largest hospital in Gaza, the lifeline of the Palestinian healthcare system in Gaza. You're going to decimate, destroy this lifeline for people. And there was an interview with Middle East Eye, I don't know if you remember it, where a journalist is interviewing Ehud Barak. And Ehud Barak was saying, we are determined to destroy it and we will, you know, so revealing exactly what aspirations the Israeli occupation forces have and query whether those aspirations are good ones. Very early on, the aspirations were, we are determined to destroy a hospital. So this is the new world that Israel wants you to live in, where destruction of a hospital is just totally acceptable course of action that the Israeli occupation forces can just decide to do and then fully implement without any pushback or any question about whether this is not just totally insane. And they didn't initially do it when they had promised to at the beginning of this genocide. They carried out various attacks of Al-Shifa, including bombing the solar panels, including bombing the maternity ward, including fully besieging the hospital in November for multiple days, leading to the staff on the inside to have to actually drink saline solution because they were completely dehydrated and no food or water was coming into Al-Shifa, because anyone who tried to exit Al-Shifa in November was shot by a quadcopter or an Israeli sniper. And when I spoke to Dr. Mohammed Harara, who was one of the doctors, who was one of the last doctors to leave Al-Shifa Hospital at the time of the siege in November, and he said, we were sieged for 6 days without food or water. And I asked him, how did you survive on an Instagram live back in November? He said, we had to drink saline solution because it was the only thing we had to hydrate ourselves.
Do you remember the time when we were... not we, because we knew what happened, but there were people who were debating whether or not the Zionists had bombed a hospital. And the Zionists were like, oh, no, we would never do that. They were actually positing that it was Palestinians who bombed their own hospital. Do you remember that time? It doesn't seem that long ago. They were trying to convince people that they would never do anything like that. And now they are taking pride in the destruction of a medical infrastructure.
100%. 100%. And not only that, you know, they were not even required to explain to the international community what they did, because it just so happened that the destruction of Al-Shifa Hospital and the surrounding medical complex coincided with Israel's targeted assassination of those World Central Kitchen volunteers in three convoys that were traveling to deliver humanitarian aid. And one by one, they were targeted in precision airstrikes on the center of the vehicle, the part which says World Central Kitchen on it was hit with a missile. We know from the reports that when the individuals in the first car hit, they ran to join the second car. Then the second car was hit. Then the survivors from that car went to the third car. And then the third car was hit until every single volunteer was killed. And Israel got a lot of public, you know, flack for killing these, you know, mostly foreign nationals. One of them was Palestinian. But because we know that the mainstream media places more emphasis and care on, you know, the lives of foreign nationals, the media cycle was obsessed with the targeted assassination of these aid workers when Palestinians are saying they've been doing this the entire time. They've been killing UN workers. They've been killing aid workers. They happen to be Palestinian aid workers, but nonetheless, they are aid workers and Palestinian lives are not less meaningful than the lives of foreign nationals. This is just exactly what they've been doing and fully consistent with their behavior that has gone completely unhinged. And when they do it to Palestinians, the world doesn't say very much. And so now they've done it to foreign nationals. And by the way, they've killed foreign nationals before. And it's never really mattered because their governments don't really care very much. They killed Rachel Corey. They killed Tom Herndahl. They killed a Turkish-American dual national on the Mavi Marmara. They've killed even Palestinians with other nationalities during the Gaza genocide, right? And their home countries never take up their cause, even though these are targeted assassinations of civilians, because it's more important for them to continue to support the Israeli apartheid machine. I was watching a lot of the Electronic Intifada coverage on the World Central Kitchen, and they made the excellent point that we need to be very wary about the activities of this organization because it is being brought in, one, as a sort of like replacement to UNRWA, when UNRWA is the only organization that has the capacity, the knowledge, the history to be able to serve the Palestinian population in Gaza. Why is it that World Central Kitchen is being allowed to operate when UNRWA is being completely banned from operating and completely suspended and prevented from its operations as a result of the Israeli siege and Israeli control over UNRWA's operations during this genocide? Why is it that World Central Kitchen was allowed through? And I think Ali Abu Ni'ma made the point that clearly the US and Israel have a vision for what the post-genocide reality is going to look like for Palestinians. And it's one that does not include UNRWA anymore because they hope that they will be able to extinguish the Palestinian right of return through extinguishing UNRWA, even though that's not how the international law works in any event. But that's what clearly one of their policy objectives. They've shown that their intentions very, very clearly through the campaign to defund UNRWA and withholding of funds for UNRWA from the US and other Western governments, some of whom have restored funding, but others who have maintained the suspension of funding. So that's the first point about World Central Kitchen. The second point about them is that even their operations, Ali Abu Ni'ma went through what it is that they were actually doing. They're serving such a small percentage of the Palestinian population in Gaza, something that is so small and so not comparable to what UNRWA was doing prior to the genocide. And so therefore, it's a trickle. It's a PR move. Look, no, look, we're letting these guys in. They're delivering aid. There's no starvation in Gaza as a result, right? And that's what all of these, you know, theatrical moves, the airdrops, the different organizations that they do allow, you know, serve to do in this moment, which is to deflect and allow them to say, no, no, there's actually no problem here. You know, obviously, in total contrast to the consensus of all of the UN agencies and all of the experts who have evaluated the situation and said, no, 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 people are starving to death. And Palestinians who are showing their children being like, they've starved to death. And now I'm burying my child who's just skin and bones. But all of this to say is that that entire event took massive attention away from the Al-Shifa hospital massacre. And so therefore, I want to spend some time today talking about the massacre, talking about what happened during the massacre. Mondo Weiss just released an article describing what took place during the massacre. Obviously, it's just a fraction of what actually happened and what crimes Israeli occupation forces committed. But I think it's worth our attention because it will be remembered. And even though it's just a fraction of the events that took place, it's certainly worth our attention because the Al-Shifa hospital massacre is going to be remembered by Palestinians as one of the largest massacres in our history committed by the Zionist forces, akin to the massacres of Deir Yassin that feature so prominently in the Palestinian psyche and consciousness that we continue to remember 75 years later. So that's what the Al-Shifa Hospital massacre is going to be for us. So let's take a listen to some of the things that took place. So Mondo Weiss writes, "And hundreds of corpses piled up and buried in mass graves are all that remained of the victims of the massacre at Al-Shifa Hospital. The grim scene was something out of a dystopian movie, the product of the two-week siege of Gaza's largest hospital that ended in its total destruction. Mondo Weiss contacted many survivors of the events at Al-Shifa. Most of them refused to speak and feared exposing their identities. A few accepted under the condition of anonymity, fearing that their testimonies would make them targets by the Israeli army and that they would subsequently be killed. In light of the testimonies gathered by Mondo Weiss, a different picture emerges of what happened. Different, of course, than the Israeli narrative. The soldiers entered the compound. Everyone was ordered to evacuate the buildings. Drones carrying speakers broadcast the army's orders, telling people that they must exit and gather in the courtyard. The drones kept saying, 'Come out, you animals.' When everyone left the buildings, the army began to separate the crowds of people into groups, making each group wear differently colored plastic bracelets. Soldiers told them that these bracelets were connected to a system that alerts snipers to their movements. They were divided into two colors, yellow, which was attached to hospital staff and whoever the army considered civilians, and red, which was given to people who could not move on their own, such as patients, the injured, amputees, or people with broken limbs. The army also gathered people who they suspected of belonging to Hamas or to the PIJ. They were not given bracelets, but were separated from the injured and hospital staff, who were sent to a different building. A third, much larger group was ordered to leave the hospital entirely. Thousands of displaced persons who had been sheltering in the compound, in addition to some members of the hospital staff. Some of the staff members, including doctors, refused to leave. When they refused the army's orders, they were executed immediately without argument." Just going to pause here for a second. Doctors who refused to leave their patients were executed immediately by the Israeli occupation forces. There's no justification for this at all. Under the most expansive reading of international humanitarian law, there is no justification for this. "The army then brought out a huge number of men, gathering them in the center of the courtyard. It then proceeded to execute them one after the other. When the slaughter was done, army bulldozers piled up their corpses in the dozens, dragging them through the sand and burying them. Nature of this offensive, that in and of itself is illegal. And we know from Francesca Albanese's report, The Anatomy of a Genocide, the UN Special Rapporteur, who analyzed 6 months of what Israel has been doing in Gaza, that Israel uses the language of international humanitarian law as a cover for its genocidal activities. So even when it says, "Oh, no, no, we were just targeting Hamas. All those people we executed were Hamas. So therefore, they were legitimate targets." No, that's not how international humanitarian law works. People are not legitimate targets if they're not engaged in actual combat. Right? The notion of targeting a combatant versus a civilian. Combatants are only combatants when they have arms in their hands, right? Not when you just suspect them of being combatants and you've gathered them up from a hospital and they're not armed. Because what they're saying is, we suspected them as being part of, not that they were actually engaged in combat. So again, it's another manipulation and twisting of international law, right? So I want us to pay close attention to not only what Israel's doing, but like the premise, the underlying logic, which is completely twisted and completely manipulation of international law, but also anything that is decent. Do we really want to live in a world where just because Israel decided that, you know, they can just say that these people belong to a political movement, so then therefore we rounded them up in a courtyard and executed them one by one? And we know for a fact that that's not even true, because the Palestinians, the witnesses, the survivors who have been coming out and sharing their testimonies about what happened, they all said the same thing. The people who were killed were civilians. They were our fathers, brothers. They were displaced people. They were patients. They were doctors. So no matter how you look at it, it's wrong on all accounts. There's just no justification for this. And we would not accept this with any other people. But with Palestinians, the world wants us to accept that Palestinians who are suspected of belonging to a political organization, that they're fair targets for assassination. And we never have to prove that they were actually part of that organization or not. We can just do it and get away with it. I'll go on. "As this was ongoing, other soldiers stormed various buildings in the compound in search of people who refused to evacuate when the initial order was given. They killed anyone they found." Again, assassinating anyone on no basis except for the fact that they refused to evacuate a hospital. Now, think about this. Who are the people who would refuse to evacuate a hospital? Perhaps it's people who couldn't evacuate a hospital. Perhaps it's people who were sick. Perhaps it's people who were immobile. Perhaps it's doctors who were insistent that providing medical care is their right and that this is a human right, that they will not succumb to the genocidal orders of the Israeli occupation forces. There's a lot of good reasons to violate or to not listen to the orders of the Israeli occupation.
There's actually no good reason to listen to anything the Zionists have to say or their orders ever.
There were some in the hospital who resisted, including police officers. That number of people was minor, and their resistance did not save them. They were killed along with those who did not put up any resistance. So the scene that emerges is the Israeli occupation killing absolutely everyone that they encountered. That's the scene that's emerging, right? They separate people into groups. They give them these, you know, armbands, which, by the way, I saw several testimonies of survivors that were posted in the hours and days after the massacre, including people who had the armbands. And they were like, yeah, they separated us into different groups. They gave us different color armbands. People were executed and dealt with accordingly. It just begs the question, like, is this the world we want to live in? Where you can just round people up, separate them into different color-coded categories and execute them, then take their bodies and, you know, load them onto, you know, bulldozers and, you know, bury them in a mass burial, mangled with dirt in just total impunity. Is that the world that you, when you were a young child growing up, imagined being a part of? For me, the answer is clearly no. It's a nightmare. You know, everything that they do is a nightmare.
Yeah, they would have used a yellow Star of David, but it's actually already been in use.
Amira Al-Safadi, a female doctor from Al-Shifa Hospital, provided a testimony that was posted on social media. And she said, after the first day of the attack, the army ordered us not to leave when it entered. Then on the second day, gave us bracelets and emphasized that we had to wear them and that anyone who left the building without wearing one would be immediately killed. We were sent to 4 different buildings, she continues, describing that she joined a number of other doctors and nurses with their patients. Around 16 injured patients died because we were unable to treat them. By the time the army withdrew from Al-Shifa, the entire compound had been decimated, reducing the buildings to rubble and then burnt. The Euromed Human Rights Monitor said that the massacre at Al-Shifa was one of the largest in Palestinian history, estimating that at least 1,500 people had been killed, about half of whom were women and children. The organization also confirms that at least 22 patients were shot while in their hospital beds, while the number of displaced persons sheltering at the hospital who were forced to evacuate southward was estimated to include 25,000 people. Moreover, 1,200 housing units in the vicinity of Al-Shifa were destroyed.
Maybe the world's not paying attention because it wasn't a music festival. If only they'd been playing electronic music, it might trigger some sort of sympathy.
Euromed Human Rights Monitor estimated 1,500 people killed just at Al-Shifa alone, right? At Al-Shifa alone, 6 months into the genocide. If we are to believe that October 7th provides Israel with absolutely every excuse to commit genocide against Palestinians, a day when roughly 1,100 people were killed, half of whom were military.
Well, the first they claimed it was 1,400, but then they actually reduced it to under 12.
Some were just removed because their names were on the list twice. Then that brought it from 14 to 12, and it was 12 to now 1,100. And of those 1,100, around half are military.
Now, no, through testimony of the generals and the soldiers who were inside of the helicopters, that it was them who killed their own people.
And we have footage from the Apache helicopters showing that. We also have testimonies from the survivors of the kibbutzes who said that it was the Israeli tanks that fired on the houses, killing everybody in the house, right? All of these stories have been coming up and emerging, you know, in the many months that this genocide has been taking place, receiving absolutely no attention from the mainstream media and only available in alternative media sources, even though they are resulting from firsthand accounts and testimonies of people who were intimately affected and rely in addition on video footage. But all of that aside, we are to believe that the killing of 1,100 some people provides full justification for Israel to commit genocide. That's what they want us to believe. They say, yeah, but October 7th. And so that's why we're doing what we're doing. And so therefore, my question then is that logic only for you then? Does that logic only apply to you? Palestinians have no right to have even the reaction that you deem for yourselves to be an appropriate reaction. If you think that's an appropriate reaction to the killing of 1,100 people, how are Palestinians supposed to react to the Al-Shifa Hospital massacre, where 1,500 people were killed? Women, children, fathers, brothers, patients, doctors, patients in their hospital beds. How are Palestinians supposed to view that? And what is the appropriate reaction that Palestinians are supposed to have? Are we allowed any reaction? Or is that reaction only reserved for the occupiers? On their own logic, it all falls apart because they have inflicted on us suffering for over 75 years that they expect we are supposed to just accept and be completely okay with. How does their logic work? They're the only victims. They can only ever be the victims, and nobody else can be a victim, despite being subjected to much greater violence over a much longer period of time.
It's actually very simple. The only thing that exists is their victim complex. And you see that in tweets like the ones coming out from Michael Dixon, who said, "My youngest daughter returned home from school today with a workbook for remote learning. She said, in case we can't go to school if we are bombed by Lebanon or Iran." And then somebody else tweeted, Tamim Olive Fern tweeted, "Israel bombed 443 schools in Gaza and killed over 15,000 children."
Also, Israel's bombing Lebanon and Syria.
And has been for the last 6 months.
Right. And so it's like, if they were to bomb Israel back, it wouldn't be, again, because they just don't like them for their religion. It would be because they've been bombed by them every day for 6 months. It's this notion of perpetual victimhood. They're the only ones who can be victims. Nobody else on the planet can be a victim, regardless of being subjected to 75 years of ethnic cleansing, genocide, apartheid. Not a good enough excuse to be a victim. No, but look at us. We're the victims here, right? I think people are waking up to that. That narrative is not working. It's falling apart. Al Jazeera reported that so far, they have recovered just under 400 bodies from Al-Shifa Hospital, which is a massive number. Like, it's a massive, massive, massive number. From those bodies that were recovered, they've recovered women and children who were found buried while bound and shackled by their hands. Children shackled and bound and executed. If the aftermath does not like shock you to your core and lead you to question like what happened at that hospital that got us to the point where children were shackled, bound, and executed, if that doesn't stop you and make you go, wait a minute, like there's something wrong here, then I'm afraid there's not much hope for you as a human being. Because what else could awaken you? If that doesn't shock you to your core, like nothing will. Absolutely nothing will. And you're dead inside.
The crimes that they are committing are so heinous that people won't even reference the Nazis anymore. They will reference Zionism.
I can see that happening so much, Michael. You know, in like 10 years from now, they'll say, no, we're not like the Zionists. No. We are doing things in a humanitarian way. Do not compare us to Zionists, right? Like that will happen. There was one man who, with a swollen black eye, was interviewed on Middle East Eye. He was visibly beaten. He had a very swollen black eye. He could barely open it. He reports being sieged in his home near Al-Shifa Hospital with his elderly disabled father. The Israeli forces damaged the building that he was staying in, severely injuring him and his disabled father, trapping them under the rubble of their homes. The man tried to seek help from hospitals nearby because he was able to get out, but his father remained trapped under the rubble. But he reports emerging from the rubble of his home, walking to the various medical facilities that were nearby and finding them burnt down with the bodies of dead people littered around him. As a last resort, he pleaded with the Israeli occupation forces to help him get his father out, who then told him that since October 7th, they, quote, no longer have heart or mercy, and that anyone living in Gaza is a terrorist. More genocidal intent.
Before that, they were really known for their compassion.
Right. I shared the video on social media when I came across it, only to find out later that the elderly man who was trapped under the rubble and who was later killed, he died as a result of his injuries, is a man named Mohsen Filfil, who's my cousin Nora's great uncle And that the man who was being interviewed in the video, who was the son of the elderly man, is my cousin Nora's cousin. And I didn't know this at the time, but it's just a testament to how small Gaza is, right? And how everybody is connected and everybody is related. Very, very, very devastating news. And then we also saw from Bayan Abu Sultan, a Palestinian journalist, who recorded a vlog spanning 2 weeks from her perspective of being in her family home, steps away from Al Shifa Hospital. In the vlog, she shows how Israel bombed her neighbor's house, killing all of her neighbors. We saw her neighbor's house completely torched on fire. All of the houses in her, you know, from within eyesight of her house were bombed, were reduced to rubble. She basically reported that every single house had in it families, and therefore there were dozens and dozens of people trapped under the rubble, and nobody was coming for them. She and her family eventually escaped their home with only the clothes on their back under the fire of Israeli tanks and quadcopters after her brother was killed by an Israeli sniper who shot at him when he was standing just outside of their family home. So you're talking right now about Gaza, which has been essentially transformed into just a place, you know, where massive killing is taking place at all times. You step outside, you can be shot by a sniper. You step outside, you can be shot by a quadcopter. There is no safety or security anywhere. Not only because you can be bombed at any moment by an airstrike, by a missile, because of the lack of food, the forced starvation, but just this notion that there are snipers everywhere, there are quadcopters everywhere, and that you can and will be targeted and executed in a moment. And it's happening all the time. So Bayan had to leave her brother, who was killed during the siege of the Al-Shifa Hospital, when she and her family evacuated their homes. And she tweeted, she said, "My brother is a martyr." And then she disappeared for about a week or so from social media and then came back and tweeted that, "I survived. I survived the Israeli siege and destruction of Al-Shifa Hospital and the surrounding neighborhoods." And then I'll share just one last testimony from a man who shared his experience, which was also posted on social media, posted also by Middle East Eye. But it came from an interview from Al Jazeera journalist Anas Al-Sharif, who spoke to a Palestinian father about how his family was able to leave the vicinity of Al-Shifa Hospital after 12 days of Israeli siege and bombardment. The siege led to the martyrdom of multiple of his family members, including children who died from thirst and starvation after being trapped for 12 days in their basement. But what was really striking in his account was that he's giving this interview next to the corpse of his young daughter who died from starvation and dehydration. But he also describes the 12 days that they spent in the basement of their home, him and 37 other family members who were sheltering. And he reports that an Israeli F-16 fired on their house, completely destroying it and trapping them in the basement, where they remained in one room for 12 days. And they survived by drinking water from cans of olives and corn and even old, dirty tobacco pipe water. Literally, he said that the children were fighting over the filthy water at the bottom of the shisha, which is used to filter the tobacco, and it becomes gray and slimy. And that's all the children had to drink. And even that filthy water, they were fighting for because of how thirsty they were. A few days after that point, the children and his family began to die around him from starvation and dehydration, including his daughter Hadia. His nephew at one point tried to leave to find water, and he was killed by an Israeli quadcopter who fired on him when he was walking in his neighborhood. Some of the members of the family managed to survive, but even the man who's giving this, delivering this account, is doing so visibly emaciated. Visibly emaciated. I mean, is there any horror that the people of Gaza have not lived yet? I can't quite understand the level of fear and agony and torture that a family is subjected to when their house is on top of them after being destroyed by an F-16. An Israeli tank at one point ran over their house. They're trapped for 12 days with many, many, many children. There's no food. There's no water. They're fighting over very limited, dirty resources. And one by one, they start to drop like flies and die. And then the adults are in this room with these children who have died while other children are still alive. And you have to explain to the other children that their cousins have died and passed away from starvation and dehydration. Is there any type of torture that the Palestinian people in Gaza, after 6 months of genocide, have not had to live yet? When will the world's reaction match the suffering? When will the world's reaction finally be sufficient to counter
just the mass torture that is taking place of the Palestinian people right now. And this is, you know, this is not like, the point here is not to leave us, you know, hopeless at our efforts, but it's supposed to inspire us to keep pushing even more. And to realize that, you know, in these last 6 months, sanctions have been applied. We have been able to bring about change, but we need to keep going, because if we are going to stop this massive murder machine, it will be because our efforts continue, multiply, and we are able to recruit millions more to this movement.
Yeah, really quickly, the story about families being trapped underground. If you know Jewish history, you know that during the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, the exact same thing happened, but the Nazis didn't have F-16s. There are many stories of people being trapped inside bunkers. I mean, it's worse. It's actually worse for the Palestinians right now. And I'm saying that as somebody who has family who was executed in the Holocaust. The Palestinians are experiencing a high technology Holocaust right now. One that is being propped up by the United States, both politically and economically. The Nazis managed to infiltrate the Western governments in order to continue their project in Palestine. That's what Operation Paperclip was.
I want to share just some of the messages that were scrawled onto the walls of the Al-Shifa Hospital, because you're talking about, you know, during the Holocaust, families being trapped underground. And I think there's also a parallel here between victims just writing their last words on the walls of their homes. Isn't that literally in the Anne Frank house? The pain and the truth of their plight is so evident in the messages that they left on the hospital walls, which were torched and destroyed. These messages were photographed, and they will one day, mark my words, they will one day appear in the Museum of the Gaza Genocide. Once the historical record corrects the entire narrative, it's so obvious to me that that's where this is going, but we're not there yet. And yet there are still many people in this moment who have that foresight, who are the truth tellers, who are saying exactly where this is headed. And so let's listen to what they had to say. Medical team on March 28th wrote on the wall, "Be patient, O people of Al-Shifa, for relief is near. It's the 11th day of the third siege on Al-Shifa complex. The grief that I carry could crumble mountains. Oh Lord, have mercy on your servants." Another writing said, "Mom, I miss you wiping off the tears running down my cheeks." A man by the name of Muhammad Sukkar wrote, "Praise be to God. Mom, I am so exhausted, but thank God for everything still. God willing, we will get out." Another writing says, "The story is now known. Its title is Pain and Tears in the Heart of a Trapped Human, Searching for Medicine and Freedom, God Willing." Searching for medicine and freedom. We've been telling the world that all we're searching for is freedom. And from the moments of deepest despair, we continue to articulate our demand for freedom. I think this is just a moment where we need to just remind the world, listen to Palestinians, listen to what they're telling you. Listen to what they've been telling you. You know, when they've been telling you Israel's been killing aid workers, they've been killing journalists, they've been killing hospital workers, they've been killing doctors. Don't be surprised when they kill 7 foreign aid workers. It's not surprising to anyone. Not a single Palestinian was surprised.
Their treachery is not confined to Palestine, right? The occupation maintains a robust arms trade with a number of rogue regimes. Myanmar, for one, which is conducting, quote, a textbook ethnic cleansing of its Rohingya minority, is among the beneficiaries. This is a quote from investigative journalist by the name of John Brown.
Yeah, no relation.
Like, not the other John, not a descendant, to my knowledge, of the other John Brown who led an enslaved rebellion and worked with General Harriet Tubman. He said, quote, "If countries want the best arms, then they probably go to the U.S. and Europe. But when no one else will sell to you, they turn to Israel." Zionist firms have broken with the United States and Europe by supplying weapons and surveillance equipment to militias in South Sudan, where the civil war has raged since late 2013. some 300,000 Sudanese are believed to have been killed in fighting. And it's not just in South Sudan, but also true across the border, where occupation surveillance equipment was reportedly used by the Ugandan government to spy on and arrest LGBTQ activists. It isn't restricted to Africa either. Occupation arms can be seen used by oppressive regimes from Burma and the Philippines to Colombia. Zionist training of police forces as well is felt in St. Louis as well as the favelas of Rio de Janeiro. Military export and training has become one of the occupation's main incomes, as well as diplomatic tools. Over the summer, it was revealed that the occupation's defense officials approve 99.8% of all requests for arms export licenses, as well as fueling the current violence in Myanmar and South Sudan. The occupation has been accused of clandestinely providing arms used in notorious past episodes of genocide and ethnic cleansing in places such as Rwanda, the Balkans, Chile, Argentina, Sri Lanka, Haiti, El Salvador, and Nicaragua, South Africa, obviously during apartheid South Africa. South Sudanese soldiers reveal that they secretly acquired occupation-made assault rifles. NGOs have urged continued sanctions against the Democratic Republic of Congo mining giant Dan Gertler, who is a Zionist billionaire and has acquired a number of mining licenses. The occupation repatriated military instructors from the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Just on Rwanda, just a few days ago, the president of the apartheid regime in Israel went to Rwanda to commemorate the 1994 genocide against the Tutsi, despite the fact that Israel provided weapons in order for that genocide to take place. And their Supreme Court ruled that their weapons exports to Rwanda during the genocide would stay secret.
Oh, yeah. He went to commemorate his own job well done. And then there is obviously the support for the Bosnian genocide at the hands of the Serbians, right? Which the occupation was involved in as well. And the instance of the billionaire oligarch who is enabling Haiti's murderous gangs. Businessman Gilbert Biggio is facing penalties for his alleged involvement in the violence that has engulfed the country during Prime Minister Ariel Henry's corrupt reign. And this is a snippet from the article. Haiti's rich evade their taxes, especially import duties. What's more, Canada directly accused Gilbert Biggio and two others of, quote, money laundering and other acts of corruption. And one former government official told me that way back in the 1950s, the Biggios had imported Uzi submachine guns from the occupation for the François Papadoc Duvalier dictatorship. Weapons trade may thus have already been a component of the family business model.
Yeah, so look, they're everywhere. They're involved in a lot of bad things. Violations of human rights extend far beyond Palestine, and these are themes that have come up over and over on the Palestine Pod. It's good to remind ourselves of this, right? Continually remind ourselves of this so that we don't think that we're only focused on a fight for Palestine. The fight for Palestine is representative of a fight for all humanity, in the sense that it's the right of humans to live as free people.
And it also destroys the Zionist talking point, like, why don't you care about all the other things that are going on? And it's like, we do. And also, the occupation is responsible for those too.
Want to just shed some light on a post that Professor Noor Arakat made a few days ago, summarizing the diplomatic weapons and other sanctions, commercial sanctions that have been imposed on apartheid Israel since the beginning of this genocide. I'm not going to go through all of them, but I think it's exactly this type of post that we need to remind ourselves that the work that we are all doing is having an impact. It is bringing to light the situation. It is changing people's minds, and it is putting pressure on those with power to use that pressure to enact sanctions. And we don't hear enough about it. It doesn't mean that it's not taking place. It also doesn't mean that it's sufficient. We need to keep pushing. But this is proof that these sanctions are starting to take place, and that, you know, in the same way that apartheid South Africa fell, we need to get to that point where apartheid Israel is completely isolated, where every country that has relations with it has cut those relations. The apartheid regime will no longer be able to sustain itself, and it will crumble on itself. So I'm not going to review the diplomatic sanctions or the commercial sanctions. They're in her post. She posted it on day 184 of the genocide. You guys can check it out on her Instagram and on her Twitter account. But I want to just go on the weapon sanctions because I think this is really important. So on January 8th, Canada stopped approving new arms export permits to Israel. The freeze is intended to continue until Canada can ensure that weapons are used in accordance with Canadian law. On March 18th, the Canadian Parliament voted to end arms exports to Israel. Over 180 MPs called for banning all arms sales to Israel. On February 5th, citing the ICJ ruling, Itochu Aviation, a division of Itochu Corporation and Nippon Aircraft Supply Co., ended their partnership with Israel's main arms manufacturer. This is a Japanese company. On February 6th, Belgium suspended two arms export licenses for the export of gunpowder to Israel. The decision was prompted by the ICJ ruling. In February, a Dutch court ordered the Dutch government to stop sending spare parts for F-35 fighter jets to Israel due to the clear risk of international human rights law being violated in Gaza. On February 29th, the president of Colombia suspended all purchases of weapons from Israel following the Flower Massacre, right? So it's not just the exporting of arms, but it's also refusing to do business with and purchase arms from the occupation, which is a massive arms dealer, as Michael just reminded us. On February 29th, the Spanish Socialist Workers' Party, the main ruling party in Spain, voted in parliament along with other parties in favor of an immediate suspension of Spain's arms trade with Israel. On March 6th, the government of Chile banned Israel from participating in the 2024 International Air and Space Fair. This is exactly the type of isolation that we need to see continue, but with urgency and just proliferate into all aspects of dealing. They must be cut off in every single space where they are accustomed to being welcome. It's probably not even an exhaustive list, but that's just the beginnings of what this new way forward needs to be. We're not going back to the status quo. We're not going back to permanent occupation and slow incremental killing of Palestinians and ethnic cleansing. Those days are over. And now we have to be accelerating, you know, with full urgency and energy ahead. And focusing really on the sanctions, the S part of BDS, right? Boycott and divestment need to continue. But right now, I feel like all of our efforts need to be focused on the outside, because that's what we can do, on getting sanctions approved.
And we are on our way. This is a new Gallup poll from March 27th, 2024. Majority in the U.S. now disapprove of Israeli action in Gaza. Approval has dropped from 50 to 36 since November. Americans now oppose the campaign by a solid margin. 55% currently disapprove of Israel's actions, while only 36% approve. That's from March 2024. And it's obviously down from November 2023, where 50% approved and only 45% disapproved. There's people who said that they have no opinion, we're not interested in them.
What do you call them, Michael? Spineless?
Gelatinous invertebrates.
Gelatinous. Yeah, gelatinous. I love that word. I love that word.
Spineless people who have no opinion on the current genocide happening to the Palestinian people.
Just like a public service announcement, no opinion, not going to look good in a few years.
But those people will for sure say they were on the right side. They're the people who are like, I supported Mandela the whole time. And what I'm realizing is that those people would have slapped the cuffs on Mandela himself. It's like, we want to end with something positive. We want people to understand that their impact, that the actions that they're taking are having an impact. The boycotts are working, right? McDonald's and Starbucks CEOs are fucking crying publicly about their losses, right? They're like, I know we said some stuff, we messed up. Like now, they're like, we're neutral. We care about human rights. Like, they're making these blanket statements, trying to walk back their initial full-fledged support for the occupation.
Yeah. And even like even Biden right now, the language that is, oh, I'm outraged. We know he doesn't care. We know he doesn't care. We know he's sending the weapons. But it's this posturing of I'm outraged, right? Why does he even feel the need to fake that, right?
It's because so many people are uncommitted in who they're voting for that even his team is giving him the feedback like, you need to at least say that you care. We'll continue to quietly approve the weapons.
Right. And that just goes to show how stupid they think everyone is, because people do not care what he says. They care about the weapons and the funds that are being funneled there, and not just, you know, the newspaper heading that says Biden is outraged as the weapons continue.
Occupation exhausted their supply of bombs. That's why they need a resupply from the United States. We are seeing that the axis of resistance from Yemen and from Iraq and from within Palestine, they are not exhausted. They are still operating at like 90% capacity, according to them.
And just to be clear, the weapons transfers are continuing. At the end of March, the Biden administration approved a new U.S. arms package worth billions of dollars, which included the transfer of more than 1,800 2,000-pound bombs to Israel. If you'll remember, the 2,000-pound bombs are the ones that can kill people 300 meters away. They featured as part of South Africa's petition, oral argument, as part of the genocide case, because the idea is if you drop 2,000-pound bombs that are intended to kill people 300 meters away on a refugee camp, you can't say you're just targeting Hamas. The point is the genocide. The goal is the genocide. And yet they continue to use these bombs on one of the most densely populated places on Earth and continue to buy them from the United States, even though their usage de facto, just the usage alone, is indicative of genocidal intent and genocidal action. And yet as late as the end of March, 1,800 more of those bombs were sent to Israel for use on the Palestinian people in Gaza. So don't believe for a second any words that come out of the Biden administration about how he's outraged, about how he is frustrated with Netanyahu. If he was frustrated, he wouldn't have sent bombs, the purpose of which is to kill civilians in mass in this torturous way, 300 meters away. Do you understand?
Big whoopsie when they kill aid workers, but when they bomb a refugee camp, that was on purpose. Anyways, don't get to a place where you feel like what you're doing is not having an impact, because if you listen to this podcast, if you're somebody who is actively engaged in the struggle for Palestinian liberation, whether it be protest, whether it be disruption, whatever it is you do, it's having an impact right now. Keep it up and keep the pressure on them. They cannot sustain this. We can. Folks, that's been another episode of the Palestine Pod. Thank you all so much for listening. Check out our full episodes and sources at www.palestinepod.com. Send us an email at palestinepod@gmail.com. Follow us on Instagram at the Palestine Pod. And please consider supporting the project on Patreon, www.patreon.com/palestinepod. That's been another episode of the pod. Thank you all so much for listening. Have as good a day as you can.
We can start telling people to join the Patreon. The show wouldn't be possible without a Patreon. You gotta get on our Patreon. Support us on Patreon. You can, you know, because like I've been watching all these other podcasts and they just keep plugging Patreon like all the time.
Yeah, I'm gonna clip what you just did right now.
Okay.